This is a recording of the audit hearing held by the Federal Election Commission on August 23rd, 2012. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning and welcome to the audit hearing for the McCain-Palin 2008 General Committee and McCain-Palin Compliance Fund Incorporated. We're joined this morning by Mr. Trevor Potter, Mr. Matt Sanderson, and Mr. Sal Papuro. Thank you for joining us and welcome back, former Chair Potter. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. This is our eighth audit hearing pursuant to a policy that went into effect on July 2009. And as you may know, we typically don't vote on anything at the end of the hearing. We, you know, answer, we ask questions and listen to your opening presentation, and we may signal where we plan to go in the future. But as a matter of course, we don't typically vote, and we will not vote today on the audit documents. Mr. Potter, do you have an opening presentation this morning?
I do. Thank you very much. I would note at the outset, well, first, it's a pleasure to be here. Secondly, we had provided the commission with just a couple of slides that were basically background information for the presentation I'm about to make. It turns out that you all would have had to move from your seats and sit behind me to see the screen. And since the slides do not walk you through this presentation, I didn't think that was useful to you. You have those, I believe, and we will leave them here. We also have a PowerPoint format that walks through these same issues that I did not want to put up on the screen and have you have to walk through. I'd rather discuss it with you, but we will leave copies of that for you as well. We have the 12 copies. So you will have this information in a multitude of formats. On behalf of Senator McCain and the McCain-Palin Campaign Committee, I thank you for granting our request for a hearing on this audit report. We hope and anticipate that today's discussion will be productive and will help resolve the few remaining issues the Commission's audit staff has identified. We also thank the Commission staff for its assistance during the audit process. The Commission assigned capable auditors to this process, and our compliance staff has enjoyed a good professional relationship with them throughout. This audit, which is required because the campaign accepted public funding for the 2008 presidential general election, has been a methodical review that has now occupied almost 4 years. Nearly every financial document maintained by McCain-Palin 2008 and the McCain-Palin Compliance Fund has been examined, along with many records from 7 joint fundraising committees affiliated with the campaign. As a result of this lengthy, resource-intensive examination, the Audit Division produced a draft final audit report. We believe this report demonstrates that the McCain campaign was a responsible, careful steward of public funds. The campaign spent $100 million plus, and this report is as clean as any that I can recall over 25 years as an election lawyer for a presidential general election. Notably, the report contains no allegations that public funds were misused, expenditure limitations were exceeded, or contributions were unlawfully accepted. Instead, the report identifies just 2 outstanding matters that we believe are, from an objective standpoint, relatively minor. This clean bill of health is a testament to the campaign's strong commitment to compliance and to following the Commission's regulations and precedents. From the beginning, Senator McCain and the campaign's leadership made legal compliance a top priority by committing considerable resources to compliance and by retaining experienced compliance staff. In addition to the campaign's legal team, represented here today by myself and my colleague on the campaign and at Kaplan and Drysdale, Matt Sanderson, the campaign had a highly experienced accounting and compliance team as well. That team is represented here today by Sal Papuro, who was the campaign's comptroller. He has the distinction of now having worked as a financial officer for six presidential campaigns and is intimately familiar with FEC audits and press reimbursement issues as the budget officer for the Bush-Cheney 2000 and 2004 committees. So I will defer all hard accounting questions to Sal. The campaign also benefited from the consulting experience of Keith Davis, who was in the hearing room today and has been a respected senior compliance and accounting professional in presidential campaigns for more than 30 years, going back to the Howard Baker 1980 campaign. The campaign also brought in another highly experienced professional, Sandy Pack, who is here today as well, to design and monitor all travel reimbursements. She was the CFO of the Bush campaign and created and used the same methodology and tracking systems for the McCain campaign that had been used by the Bush campaigns previously. One issue identified in the report, the 48-hour notices for compliance fund donations that were not filed due to an outside vendor's data management error, does not seem to be a matter of factual dispute between the campaign and the commission. Accordingly, although we are happy to answer any questions you might have about those 48-hour notices, we expect that today's dialogue will focus on the other issue identified by the draft final audit report, reimbursement calculation methods for press travel. As an initial matter, I note that a misnomer has crept into the discussion of press reimbursement calculation methods. The audit division, perhaps pulling a term of art used in past presidential audits where it was more appropriate, has suggested that the campaign, quote, overbilled members of the press for travel. However, a more careful reading of the audit division's findings shows that the division does not actually allege that any ineligible or excessive travel expenses were billed to the press for reimbursement. In fact, FEC staff is on record several times declaring that the total amount billed and received by the McCain campaign was a legally proper amount. For example, on page 10 of the preliminary audit report, we read, the audit staff agrees that when using the total Swift Air LLC contract amount for both the primary and the general election periods, the General Committee did not receive travel reimbursement from the press that exceeded the maximum allowed by the regulations. The Audit Division is therefore not using the term overbilled to connote that the campaign overcharged the press. Instead, statements in the preliminary audit report and final draft audit report plainly indicate that, although the Audit Division believes the campaign collected the proper total from the press, they think the General Committee received too much of that total and the Primary Committee received too little of that total. This is, at most, a case of misallocation of press reimbursement receipts between the two McCain committees, with no net harm to the traveling press. It is important to identify it as such. Let me begin by explaining the background of the McCain campaign plane at issue here today. Once Senator McCain became the nominee apparent of the Republican Party in the spring of 2008, the campaign began exploring aircraft leasing options. As everyone well knows, the primary campaign until that time had used everything from small leased planes to regularly scheduled commercial service with the senator traveling alone and carrying his own bag, depending on the campaign's financial fortunes at the moment. But, as the new nominee apparent, Senator McCain would be spending the summer and fall traveling with staff and with Secret Service protection and a large national press corps, and they were most easily accommodated in a dedicated charter aircraft, available for campaign use when needed. The slides I think you have or will have a nice picture of this charter aircraft. This charter is the same pattern followed by every other presidential general election campaign I am aware of, except for incumbent presidents traveling on Air Force One. The campaign reviewed several proposals from charter companies and selected the one it thought was best from Swift Air. It provided for the exclusive use of a dedicated aircraft for 4 months, from late July to early November. The aircraft would be modified to provide working space, a press interview area, and telecom capabilities. Leasing consultants advised the campaign that the price would be lower the longer the term, so it was determined early on that a single lease that encompassed both the primary and general periods would be the most economical. By contrast, the plane lease for the vice presidential candidate in September was only needed for a 2-month period, and the comparative cost to the campaign was about 15% higher for that shorter time period. It is not unusual for presidential campaigns to have long-term assets and leases that are used in both the primary and general election periods. Office leases, computers, telephone service are all examples. However, aircraft leases are unique and uniquely complicated because their costs are subject to partial reimbursement under commission regulations when the plane transports the press or Secret Service. Accordingly, the FEC requires that campaigns seek reimbursement of a reasonable estimate of the prorated per-person cost of travel on a leased aircraft. The contract the campaign signed in June of 2008 provided for Swift Air to place its modified aircraft at the campaign's exclusive disposal through the general election date. The campaign agreed to pay a total of $6.38 million for a total of up to 425.6 hours of flight time. The campaign would receive no refund if it used fewer hours and had no maximum number of hours it could use, but was required to pay an additional $15,000 for each hour over the 425.6 flown and in the contract. That $15,000 per hour cost was derived by dividing the 425.6 hours that we contracted for into the $6.38 million total lease cost. So the estimated minimum base value of an hour of flight time was $15,000. However, if fewer hours were ultimately flown by the campaign, the cost per hour would be greater, as the total amount due to Swift Air remained static. This fact is the key to today's discussion, because the question at issue is whether the committee complied with the FEC regulation requiring it to, quote, reasonably estimate the per-hour flight cost it should seek as reimbursement from the traveling press during the July to November travel period. Under the FEC's regulations, this reimbursement had to be billed by the campaign to the press within 60 days of travel. The campaign had to do this billing in a world where the eventual precise per hour cost, the total number of hours flown at the conclusion of the lease term divided into the $6.38 million lease fee, could not be known until after the election, long after much of the billing had occurred, because only then, after the election, would the campaign know the total number of flown hours it had to divide into the fixed lease payment. So, to be clear on this, it had a number that it was obligated to pay, which is the $6.38 million. It had a number of flight hours it could fly, 425, for that sum. If it flew all 425.6, it would be $15,000 an hour. However, if it flew less than that, or a lot less than that, as I will explain happened, it still had to pay the same 6.38, but now the per hour cost went up because it's flying fewer hours for that total payment. So that's what we'll take a look at. In addition, the per-hour cost of the plane under the lease did not include additional variable costs that were incurred every time the plane flew. These variable incremental costs included fuel, catering, airport landing fees, and baggage handling. The good news was that these variable costs could be tracked and assigned to a particular flight segment within the 60 days available for billing. The audit staff looked at that and had no recommendations that we had done that improperly. The unknown remained the exact per-hour cost attributable to the lease, as I've explained, which would depend on the ultimate number of hours the plane was flown over the total four-month period. The campaign's obligation to pay Swift Air for this complete lease, meanwhile, was divided in the contract into 19 equal portions of $336,000 each, one for each week of the lease. This was not based on use of the plane by the campaign, but was a simple division of the total cost of the lease. The campaign owed that 1/19th portion of the total lease payment every 7 days, whether the plane was used during that period or not. At the outset of the start of the use of the aircraft in late June, the campaign schedulers knew approximately what the travel itinerary would be for the summer, but much less about September and October. However, based on the experience of previous presidential campaigns, it seemed reasonable to expect that aircraft usage would increase during the general election period. Some of the older McCain staff still had memories of Bob Dole's 96-hour campaigning marathon the last week of the 1996 presidential campaign when he crisscrossed the country in his campaign plane using up huge numbers of flight hours. Accordingly, early on in the summer, the campaign accounting staff used a per-hour fixed cost estimate of $15,000, the minimum base number in the lease, assuming we used all the hours in the lease, plus the additional variable incremental cost per flight segment for the fuel and the catering and so forth to bill the traveling press. As it became clear that summer travel was slightly less than expected, the campaign increased the estimated per-hour fixed cost from the lease until by early September it was running approximately $19,000 per hour as the campaign's estimate. These were the costs paid by the traveling press through the primary period and the convention. As we now know, things did not work out quite as expected for the McCain campaign when it reached the fall of 2008 at several levels. Down in the weeds of reimbursable costs for campaign travel, it turned out that usage of the plane in October and November was less than budgeted. There were several reasons for this, all due to the unusual nature of the fall 2008 campaign. First, the September financial crisis resulted in Senator McCain suspending campaigning for a period of days and returning to Washington, D.C. Second, the target states on which the campaign would focus much of its efforts crystallized to a group of states primarily in the industrial Midwest, resulting in short-haul flights and less cross-country travel to the mountain and coastal West. This, in turn, resulted in greater utilization of bus tours in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, to the detriment of the expected airplane travel. As an example, in the last week of the campaign, Senator McCain spent November 1st and 2nd traveling from Virginia to Allentown, Pennsylvania, to Newark, New Jersey, to Philadelphia, to Scranton, Pennsylvania, to New Hampshire. The corollary effect of this on press reimbursement calculations, of course, was that the fewer hours flown than budgeted meant the cost of the lease per hour was rising. When the election was over and the accounting dust had settled, the campaign determined that the average fixed cost of the aircraft lease was $25,000 per hour, which is the total number of hours actually flown divided into the fixed lease payment. Both we and the auditors agree that the total amount billed to the press for this four-month period was correct, But it is also clear that the general received more of those funds after the fact allocation than it should have, and the primary less. So the question before the commission today in this audit report is what, if anything, to do about those facts. The audit staff and the campaign disagree about what all of this means and what the available options are. The campaign's position is that it made a reasonable estimate of the traveling press's pro rata share of the costs of the plane, just as the commission's regulations required it to do on a contemporaneous basis. It used experienced staff who had performed these same functions in similar circumstances on other presidential campaigns. The staff was familiar with previous FEC audits of press reimbursements and travel expenses and followed FEC precedent. They acted reasonably in estimating costs in a situation where actual costs could not be finally determined until after the election, and where the general election campaign travel diverged from expectations and historical precedent. Now, after the campaign is long over, the auditors say they would have preferred the campaign had used a different methodology, one that they and the commission have not enunciated before. First, we do not believe the regulations permit the commission to substitute the auditor's new preferred methodology for the one reasonably used by the campaign. The regulation requires the campaign to make a reasonable estimate of pro rata travel costs and seek reimbursement of that amount within 60 days. It did, using the same methods utilized by previous campaigns, methods that were not previously questioned by the Commission's audit or legal staff. The Commission should not second-guess that complicated and careful process now, unless the Commission concludes that the campaign's methodology was somehow unreasonable or adopted in bad faith. Second, we respectfully disagree that the auditor's proposed methodology is in any sense better than the one used by the campaign. They suggest hanging everything on the weekly pro rata payments to the charter company and dividing those automatic weekly payments by the number of hours flown each week. This ignores the unified nature of the contract, $6.38 million for up to 425.6 hours. Instead, it would divide the weekly lease payments of $336,000 amongst 6 hours for some weeks of travel and up to 19 hours of flight time other weeks, resulting in per-hour costs varying from $54,000 a week to $16,000 a week. The press corps would have rioted if it had been presented with such varying and disparate bills for travel, enormous one week compared with their colleagues who flew the next busier week. Further, we respectfully suggest that such a new policy, dividing costs depending on how the campaign and the vendor chose to structure payments, would be problematic for the Commission going forward. The Commission standard has always been that costs should be allocated between committees on a benefits-derived basis, not on when the campaign chose to make payments. If the Commission changes that standard now to the payment date standard, it would be easy to see how future campaigns could structure their contracts to shift their costs to whichever entity, primary or general, was most advantageous, regardless of the real purpose or benefit of the expenditure. Finally, it is important to note that the resolution of this issue does not really affect the media entities that made reimbursements for travel. As already noted, the total paid for press travel on the plane was the correct amount. The issue is an accounting one between the primary and general committees. Interestingly and importantly, a preliminary review of the press organizations making payments to the primary and general indicates that they are almost entirely the same in both cases. This is not really surprising. It is likely that a newspaper or network that decides to send reporters to cover a presidential election will cover the campaign in both the summer and the fall. However, it means that any misallocation of travel costs was largely a wash. Essentially, the same entities that paid less in the primary were the ones that paid more in the general. Therefore, the committee believes there is a good faith argument that the commission should require no further action here. The campaign made a reasonable estimate, as required by the regulations, at the time the travel and billing occurred. The total amount collected was not inflated. The press entities on either end of the transaction are largely unaffected. We think that declining in these circumstances to require any further action by the committee would be a sensible and appropriate decision. However, if the committee wants to mandate the committee, sorry, if the commission wants to mandate the committee go back and use 2020 hindsight to square up these accounts, then we believe that the correct way to do that is for the general committee to transfer the amount at issue to the primary, thereby putting everything in the right box. My colleague Matt Sanderson will now briefly address the commission's precedent and regulations in regard to such a transfer. Matt?
Thank you. As Trevor mentioned, the campaign proposes to rebalance the press reimbursements by transferring funds from the general election committee to the primary election committee. The staff responded to that, the FEC staff responded to that proposal and rejected it on the basis that it would not be a qualified campaign expense and would be subject to a qualified campaign expense restriction in 9004.4. We believe this assertion is flawed for a few different reasons, first of which is that it seems to be self-contradictory. On the one hand, staff is saying that the General Election Committee is not able to hold these press reimbursements because they are excessive because they are, quote, attributable to the primary election or the primary campaign. In the next breath, in the next sentence, the staff seems to be saying that these primary election press reimbursements cannot be transferred to the primary election committee because they are also now subject to the qualified expense restriction that only applies to funds, quote, received under 11 CFR Part 905, which is the general election grant. It's not apparent how a single set of press reimbursements can be both, quote, attributable to the primary campaign and simultaneously subject to the qualified campaign expense restriction. In addition to that, we believe it's the FEC staff's interpretation of this and the application of that qualified campaign expense restriction contradicts the plain text of that restriction. As I mentioned, the restriction only applies only to general election public funding, quote, general election funding payments received under 11 CFR Part 905. Now, no attempt has been made, as far as we can tell, by the FEC staff to explain how press reimbursements attributable to the primary campaign are somehow restricted or equivalent to funds received under Part 905. It would be possible, I guess, that you could make the argument that if these were press reimbursements that were attributable to the general election campaign, that those would be restricted because they would be offsets to an initial outlay of the general election public grant. But here, what's happened is these press reimbursements are offsets and attributable to an initial outlay by the primary election committee. So that seems to us very different from funds received under Part 9005. Also, we note that the prior FEC audits have permitted payments from the general election committee to the primary election committee. The audit staff acknowledges this and says in the draft final audit report on page 19, quote, "The audit staff acknowledges that transfers were sometimes permitted when it has been shown in the course of an audit that funds or obligations belonging to a primary committee or general committee were in the possession of another. This is not the case in this instance," close quote. We note that it's not ever explained in the draft final audit report or any other document why this is not the case in this instance, why this particular set of circumstances does not meet the standard articulated by the audit staff. And in fact, we believe that it does meet the very standard articulated by the FEC audit staff. In the OGC, in the memo by the Office of General Counsel, on page 5, they note that the General Committee received reimbursements from the press for travel costs that the Primary Committee paid to Swift Air for primary campaign transportation attributable to the primary campaign. If you were to reword that, I think another way to put that would be that funds belonging to the Primary Committee were in the possession of the General Committee. And that is essentially the standard articulated by the FEC staff of when those types of payments were allowed in the past. So again, we believe that a rebalancing payment that's proposed by the general by the committee and the campaign is not prohibited under FEC rules, and in fact has been done under previous circumstances very similar to this.
Thank you, Matt. Thus, we believe that a transfer from the general to the primary is permissible here if required to rebalance, as Matt put it, between the primary and the general election accounts. However, we don't think you have to reach that unless you decide to require further action rather than accept the campaign's reasonable estimates and leave things where they are now. Finally, I indicated at the outset that there was no factual dispute between the committee and the auditors over the missing 48-hour reports for certain contributions made to the GLAC, the Compliance Committee, towards the end of the general election period. The campaign's vendors have admitted they miscoded certain contributions, and as a result, those contributions were not identified for inclusion in the 48-hour reports the committee filed. We respectfully suggest the Commission take no further action on this matter. The sums involved were not large, and none of the funds contributed were ever used in the election. As you know, compliance funds are prohibited by law from being used for election purposes. Therefore, this vendor error had no effect on the election itself. And the purpose of the 48-hour disclosure rule is to identify last-minute funding that might affect the election outcome. That concludes our presentation. Matt, Sal, and I are happy to answer any questions that you may have. I thank you for your patience as we walked through this.
Thank you very much for your very comprehensive and informative presentation. Any questions from commissioners? Commissioner McGinn?
Ruin the fun, but yes. I'm trying to make sure I have the issue right, because sometimes I hate to invoke Goldilocks and the Three Bears, but this could be that situation where everyone assumes that's about Goldilocks sleeping and three bears coming and terrorizing her, and no one ever says it's about Goldilocks breaking into the house and stealing the bear's food and sleeping in their bed. So it depends how you look at it. Because I read the audit report and I read your brief, and it seems like there's a lot of overlap and there's not a lot of disagreement in some instances. So I'm trying to whittle it down and figure out where the disagreement is. For example, in the draft report, page 11, second full paragraph, the audit staff's methodology does not conflict with 11 CFR 9004.6B3, given that the actual flight hours are known soon after flights occur. That could be true. Maybe what the auditors are suggesting doesn't conflict with the reg, but that doesn't really at all reach the question of whether what you did is right or wrong, right? And I'm not sure if this is a question of having to decide who's right, the auditors or the campaign. It really could be the reasonableness. I don't know. So I'm struggling with that, but how the auditors captioned the issue at the end, next page, the issue is whether the activity of a separate reporting and corporate entity, the primary committee, should be recognized by the general committee and by this audit. And it goes on. And that's the primary versus general is something I'm a little confused on, because at one point, Trevor, in your presentation, you said something along the lines of general got more, primary got less. And to me, I'm a little confused on that issue, because if you take it at the 10,000 foot level, you have the taxpayer grant, you can't raise any more money, you can't spend any more money, and that's really, to me, the issue. All this other stuff is details, and once we get into details, it gets a lot more complicated. So what I'm confused on is, did the primary, for lack of a better word, pick up any of the expenses of the general, or did the general pick up expenses of the primary? And if so, is it then you still did what you did in a reasonable way, therefore it's okay? Or I'm a little confused. And the thing I'm not confused on is the second argument is in the alternative. We don't reach that unless the first issue doesn't go the way you suggest. And not to get ahead of ourselves, but making the transfer to me, if we get that far, it shouldn't be a big deal, but that's just one commissioner. So if you could help me understand, because I think to me that's where the disagreement may be, is that issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I again, as I said up front, I think the auditors have worked very hard on this, and you may well be right that how you view this depends on where you sit. But I think sitting as somebody in the campaign who tried to work with the team and make sure that we were billing correctly, the line that you point out on page 11 that says the actual flight hours are known soon after the flights occur. I think I've fully explained. That's absolutely true. We would know that in some weeks we flew 6 hours, and some weeks we flew 19. What we didn't know was what each of those 6 or 19 hours would actually be worth under the contract, because that depends on how many hours are flown. We had to estimate, as we went through this, how many hours would be flown in total under the contract to come up with a per-hour cost. And during the primary period, we were thinking we'd be closer to the 400 and some hours contracted. And as it worked through in the general, it became clearer we were going to fall far short of that, and therefore the per-hour cost kept going up in our rolling estimates. On the weekly basis. So you knew how much was flown each week, and if it was continued to be under budget, then the value of that would go up. If you think of it as a sort of seesaw,
I get the formula.
Yeah.
I mean, I could come up with 10 formulas.
So I'm going to move to your...
I could do 10 formulas that make what you did look completely right, and probably come up with 10 formulas that make what you did look not right, depending on how much you slice the math.
Right.
You look at the big contract and you want to do it at the end, which makes sense to me. I can't say that's wrong. Or if you do it per week, then you're going to have this weird imbalance and you are going to have arbitrary value of flights. And it makes sense that, the guy from Press Entity 1 is going to be paying through the nose 1 week and guy from Press Entity B is going to get off on the cheap the following week. We're not in the rulemaking. We're not trying to figure out what the best rule is. I'm trying to figure out if what you did was consistent with existing rules, and I don't really hear the auditors saying. I'm not sure if I'm hearing the auditors in their materials say you're wrong, or they just have a better way of doing it, and that's an issue probably when we deliberate the audit in general we'll raise, I'll raise. But I'm trying to get a sense of primary versus general, because we have one contract. It seems to be a theme, a subtext of what I'm reading. The audit doesn't really come out and crisply say it, but and primary is beyond the scope of this audit, sort of, because you have the general lease, and I'm trying to get a sense of a simple explanation of the bigger question of you have a taxpayer-funded campaign. Did the primary pick up any of that cost? Did the general pick up any of the primary? And if the answer to that is yes, I don't think it's fatal, because I think you still have the reasonable method, and I understand why you laid out who was on the campaign, because it all goes to reasonableness. You did, as I like to say, belt, suspenders, Velcro, and duct tape to make sure everything stayed in place. And you have nothing but the A-list, and I think that's a tribute to the campaign. But I'm still trying to get a sense of what the disagreement is and what the issue is, and because this is the kind of very in the weeds. I haven't actually asked a question about the 110% rule and how that fits into this, because that's the sort of thing, unless you've actually had to do this, no one knows about the 110% rule and what that means. So if you can maybe work that into the answer, maybe that'll jog something in my memory as to what we're really talking about here.
Okay. Let's see if I can address the couple issues you've raised. You're right. You have legally two separate entities, and one of them is publicly funded. You have a lease that goes across both of them. As I've explained, that's not unique. There, you know, office space and other things do it. But those are pretty easy to calculate, because you know what the lease is for the per square footage of the office space, and one day the primary is paying it, and the next day the general is paying the same amount unless you get more space. The plane is both the same in that it bridges both of those periods, and for the reasons I've explained, different in terms of figuring out what the correct cost should be. So my metaphor here that I have found helpful in looking at this is to think of a seesaw. For the reasons we've explained, using the competent campaign professionals, and you're right, I mentioned them not because I think they've had all this experience and therefore they have to be right, but they've had all this experience, which meant the campaign was taking every step it could to do what it had to do, which is use its expertise to reasonably estimate the right number. It thought in the primary period that the plane was running at between 15 and 19,000 an hour, and that's what it was therefore charging. In the general period, it becomes clear that because it's using fewer hours, that 15 to 19, which has already been charged, is not actually going to cover the cost of the lease, is not going to be whatever the final number is. So you can't do anything about it in September and October when you realize that the primary period is, I guess it goes the other way on the seesaw, is light. And so in order to even it out, the general period is going to be heavier in billing to end up with having paid for the plane. If you could go back and have redone it, you would have said, well, we should have added more to those primary hours because we're using the plane less, and then we would have billed in the general hours more.
Is that sort of what the auditors are doing in a roundabout way? The hindsight's 20/20. I mean, because you mentioned
I think they do another
Canada,
step.
You didn't have to travel by plane as much because you stuck in the Rust Belt at the last couple weeks, and you didn't really have to fly around much. So the scale is off, but that's not an unreasonable thing to have happened.
Yeah, I think we have two different things happening here. Okay. One is that the scale is off for the reasons I've explained, and we think that we were reasonably estimating in July and August and reasonably estimating in the fall based on different circumstances, so the number was changing. But I think, and the auditors obviously can speak for themselves, but I think they're saying that you actually should have done something completely different, which is taken the weekly cost and divided it by the time flown that week, because that's really the bill for the week. And there we disagree. We think the bill to the two entities, however sliced, was the $6.38 million. And the weekly payment was irrelevant to the usage of the plane, and we think you should be looking at the usage of the plane, not the fact that the contract divided it into 19 portions.
And from the auditor's point of view, their suggested method is certainly easier from their perspective. You just look at the total weeks, divide by weeks, and that's easier.
Sure. It's easier.
It does ignore.
It ignores the two things. Should we be allowed to make the reasonable estimate we're required to make, and was our estimate unreasonable the way we did it?
Right.
And then secondly, does that method, even though easier, does it make any sense? And as I think I've explained, I think it would have a lot of adverse consequences if you went that route.
Right, because as you said, the rate would radically fluctuate week to week, and that doesn't work either. Okay.
Commissioner Walther.
Nice to see you again.
I'd
like to ask a couple of questions about one of the schedules that shows a comparison between the hourly rate as calculated by the committee and the hourly rate as calculated by audit. Do you happen to have
this is a schedule to
it's
the
a schedule
draft
that,
report?
I assume everybody has that. This is the schedule that we got yesterday.
Sent around yesterday.
The commission has it.
The center run by
did they not have a copy?
Not in this.
Did you print the
That must be a secret.
The commission
document.
Doesn't have it in this version, but they did send us. I'm sorry, the committee doesn't have it in this version, but mm-hmm. they did send us a work paper where these numbers came from. This right here was circulated to the commission yesterday.
Yeah, right. So is it possible to provide them with a copy of that page?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it was. But
thanks. We're looking at it. I obviously can't vouch for whether it's an accurate transcription of the work papers, but I see some numbers on, like the 6 hours flown versus the 19 and the 54,000 a week, et cetera, that reflect what we had seen. So we're
happy. Well, without understanding it, I just thought maybe you could clarify a couple of things. I see the calculation on the right being the one by the audit, as you can see, in my mind, would, without honing it in some other way, it lead to two arbitrary results per week to support at this point, because you see in week 8 somebody be the hourly rate would be 54,000 the way I see it. But if this is a fairly accurate schedule, then it does show that between 15,000 and 19,000 is what you were charging during the primary. Then the first week after the in the general, you're back to the 9,000, and then you bump it up almost double that. And it stays that way until the last week, and it tapers down to the point where it's only 11,000. And does that sound about right based upon how it was? I mean, I assume these figures are probably not ones you wouldn't quarrel with after all you've been through with us, so...
Yes, definitely. As we got closer to the election day, there was only a small amount of hours remaining, so it became easier to divide the number. But then the last week of the campaign, there was a lot more travel, and so that's why the price dropped dramatically. And then it was the end, so there was nothing left to bill. We were at zero.
Well, I'm not. I think your theory could be persuaded to the contrary is a pretty reasonable one, the way you're approaching this. But what I haven't seen is, at least it may be there and I missed it, is the denominator you're using every time you make a decision on how much to charge per hour. In other words, as I see, your roving denominator is how many hours are left that you expect to use, not how much is on the contract, but how much you anticipate is going to be used.
Yeah, I mean, we used block calendars based on our scheduling department on anticipation of what trips would be in the future, and then came up with the amount left in the contract and what had already been used, and did our reasonable estimate. It changed every single week after a trip was flown, and so then the next week, the billing, that's why it always changes, because we would constantly update it with new information and the facts that had already happened.
On that calculation, did you show audit what the fraction was that you were using? Do you have that?
We gave them any spreadsheet or background material that we had for our calculations, including for the primary period, even though it's not part of the audit. We did submit detailed records, bank reconciliations, and spreadsheets at their request.
Well, happened to double it the week after, the second week after the nomination? What happened then? You know, trying to talk about it sitting around in our office, you figured, well, you must have looked at the end and say, okay, now we know what was ahead of us. We pretty much know where we're going to be heading with this plane, and we're not going to use up all these hours, and we've got to, you know, make up for it somehow. So the assumption that you were using for your end use of the plane must have dramatically changed between, you know, the primary and the general.
Once the convention was over and we had our vice presidential nominee, and the, as you can imagine, the excitement from that pick was different than our original intention, and the schedule changed, and we got more information and kind of updated our projections of how many hours are going to be flown. The vice president candidate was now going to be doing rallies and events instead of fundraisers, so it allowed the senator maybe do more fundraisers for the party and joint fundraising committees. So it was just a constantly evolving thing. I can't tell you a specific event that day that might have changed our perception of what would happen. But basically we did, you know, the best we could based on evolving information.
I think also, and I'm reaching back 4 years to do this, but I think there are two factors. One is that, as you say, you know, we had been in the 18-19 range through the convention, and when they looked at it post-convention, they realized that range was low given the estimates that we were now looking at for the fall, and as Sal says, part of that is a rejiggering of expectations. The thought was that whoever, the unknown vice presidential nominee, would probably spend a lot of time moving around to fundraisers, and the general election plane of the senator would be crisscrossing more, and it looked as if we were actually going to use Palin more to do these public events on her own entirely separate plane, and that McCain might not be traveling as much. But the other thing is that that's just about when the financial crisis hits and he suspends the campaign. So
yeah, that was on week 8. Looks like.
Sorry, week 8?
Travel week 8, when there's only 6.2 hours flown.
No, that's in August, which is you know, getting ready for the convention. That's the week of his vice presidential pick. So he was sitting in Arizona. He wasn't moving around a lot. The Lehman Brothers and the Wall Street crisis was in September post convention, and I believe it is that week 11 and 12.
And if I could just add to that, my recollection is that the Olympics held in Beijing were later in August than they typically are, and that was the, as I recall, the Olympic week. So there wasn't as much campaign travel.
But I think the short answer to your question, Commissioner, is that what happened was the staff took a hard look at aircraft usage and expected usage in that earlier week and said we're not using it as much as we thought, and therefore the per hour cost is up significantly, and that pretty well stayed that way through to the very last week.
Right.
And as Sal points out, at that moment you could actually come pretty close to doing a real cost, because then you were looking at how many hours you were going to fly the last week and looking at it into the contract and looking at what you had already charged and could recognize that we had more money than we expected for that last week, so it would lower the per-hour cost so as we wouldn't overcharge.
Well, I think that's a reasonable approach, and that's kind of what I figured you were doing, and all of a sudden you got a dose of realism after the general, and you started to really look at the figures in a different way. So I'm fairly comfortable with that, but what about a situation where, because of some arbitrary figure, the actual amount of hours left gets so high that it's really beyond the reasonable rate that you'd have to charge in another commercial atmosphere? And at that point, I mean, I don't know whether 39,000 is realistic or not, but I understand that it was realistic based upon how much you had to pay and how many more hours you had to fly, so to get your money.
I mean, there's always the option if the cost is getting too expensive. I mean, one of the realities is that if the cost goes up, press organizations may send fewer people out. And I suppose in your scenario, if we had used it, less than half of what we in fact used it, so we had 100 hours of total travel on a 440-hour contract and the costs were therefore way high, the press would just not fly on our plane. At some point, there's a price figure there, but
that happened with Cheney and
Sal is whispering in my ear that actually happened with
I could see where it could
Cheney
happen
in 2000, where the costs were high enough. The press said, "We'll get there ourselves."
See at the destination. Could we get a copy? Maybe Audit has it of the actual calculations that you used when you got to that hourly rate. The numerator.
I think the staff has all that.
Okay,
they have whatever we had.
Thank you.
Madam Vice Chair?
Just want to, on a small point. So if the campaign had had more travel, perhaps they were anticipating, it sounds like what you're saying is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that earlier on, you were anticipating there would be more travel during the general than there turned out to be. So if that had happened, if it had played out the way you originally anticipated and there had been that predicted number of hours, would this whole problem have gone away?
Not necessarily, because the auditors are using the week's hours divided by that week's wire. So even if there was a lot of travel in the primary, they might still have an issue with our calculation.
Put differently, it would have gone away based on our reasonable estimates, because our reasonable estimates, in our view, would have then been absolutely right. However, if the audit staff had still taken the position that we shouldn't have been billing on actual usage but instead based on wires, then clearly there are some weeks where there's less travel and some weeks where there are more, and the numbers would be what it is in their column over here, much more disparate. But, yeah, if our estimate had been right in the general, which is the whole point of the estimate, when you're doing it in the summer, you're trying to look forward. If we'd been correct in the budgeted figures that were there for the general, then the numbers we charged in the primary would have been right, and the numbers in the general would have looked like that, too. They would have been the, 15,000 base, give a little bit.
So the numbers would have been more consistent throughout.
Right.
And it was,
right.
It was just that you didn't end up traveling as much.
Correct.
Okay.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems like what we're here to decide, Commissioner McGann touched upon it, is how does we don't have to determine what was the most reasonable method or what could have been conceivably the most reasonable method for estimating what the actual total travel costs were. The regulation says that you need to make a reasonable estimate, and so built into the regulation itself is a certain amount of imprecision. And Trevor, you'd mentioned that that at the very end you can go back and then calculate with absolute precision what the appropriate rate was, but the regulation doesn't allow for that. The regulation says you make an estimate, and then you've got to provide an invoice to the members of the press from whom you're going to seek reimbursement. So it seems like we're really in a situation of the proposal that the audit division sets forth. maybe a reasonable one. It has its advantages in terms of simplicity, but as you've pointed out, it has its disadvantages in terms of there can be some wild fluctuations in what that hourly rate is going to be from week to week. And also, you'd mentioned, I know at least in your prepared materials, that it also isn't consistent with how the actual contract was structured between the campaign and the carrier. And then you have the proposed method that that you set forward that also has its, as you admit, it has its strengths and its weaknesses. Obviously, one of its strengths from my point of view is that it's consistent with how other campaigns have done it in the past. So it really seems, from my perspective, that we're just looking at not what's the most reasonable method, but what is a reasonable method. And I've got to say, from my perspective, I can't see anything about the way that the campaign chose to estimate that seemed out of the bounds of reasonability. And I just want to go back to one thing that that you'd mentioned, Trevor, that that you actually, and correct me if I heard you wrong, that the proposed method that the audit division is setting forward may actually be in tension or may be contradictory to the regulation itself. And first of all, did I hear you correctly? And if so, could you explain why you think that why this alternative method may actually not be consistent with 9004.6?
Right. What we're pointing out is that if you use as the method for determining the cost of the plane the weekly wire transfer, two things happen. One, you end up with this larger variable, but two, you then put in the hands of the committee as a legal matter the ability to decide when they are going to incur the costs. I mean, in theory, if you're saying, well, it's a matter of when it's paid, what the contract says, et cetera. You know, what happens if we had decided we had lots of money in the primary and we structured it so that most of the money was paid in July and August and thus not in the fall so that there would be lower cost to the campaign and the publicly funded general? I think the auditors wouldn't like that as a result, but it seems to me, and traditionally you don't allow that because you say, well, you have to use a benefits derived, who actually used the plane when. And so that's our point, is that the weekly transfer doesn't use the traditional benefits derived. It instead says we're going to sort of look at the arbitrary payment of dollars. If you go that way, I think it's possible to game it and put the money where the campaign wants it in the future rather than where the benefit is.
Any other questions from commissioners? Any questions from the staff director, the audit team?
We have none.
Okay. Office. Any questions from the Office of General Counsel?
Just a couple, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Calvert.
Mr. Potter, you mentioned the benefits derived test. And, of course, in the Title 26 context, there are certain bright line rules for the allocation of benefit between a primary campaign and a general campaign. Did those rules effectively require the committee when it moved into the general election period, basically reboot its reasonable estimate process back to zero, back to the starting place? And if not, why not?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by reboot. So let me try and answer it, and if I haven't got it right, tell me. What it required is that it continue to ensure, under the requirement that it use a reasonable estimate to build a plane, that it, on a weekly basis, not just between the primary and the general, take a look at the use of the plane, the budget estimates going forward, and ensure that at that day, looking back at what had happened already and looking forward at the expected travel, that we were at the best possible per hour cost, given that we knew the total cost of the lease and we could re-estimate every week the number of hours that we thought would be flown. And so it did that on a weekly basis, including the first week of the general, looking back at what had happened before that. but it wasn't a one-time reboot. It would do it the next week as well to see if how the numbers were changing based on travel. So when the senator suspended the campaign, which nobody saw coming, it threw a complete spanner into the budget estimate because we had assumed we were going to be traveling that whole week, and suddenly we weren't. So the next week you would have to account for that, and with the less travel produce a higher number. And that occurred throughout it, not just at the switchover.
I guess what I meant by reboot was you started the process in week one of the primary and had an estimated cost, and you changed the estimate on a weekly basis. But you did have a starting point. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I'm asking is, did those rules require you to, at the changeover from the primary to the general, essentially drop a line there and go back to a starting point for estimated costs for the general election and calculate from there forward, leaving the primary's costs to the primary committee?
Well, even if we did do that, it would actually still make us at issue with the auditors because they're going on the wire payments. And if we did reboot, it would have changed the whole contract. I mean, we could have made a whole new contract starting September 1 and had a different pricing schedule. And I guess in retrospect, that would have made everything easier. But going under your bright line of September 1, we still wouldn't be in sync with what the audit division is saying we should have done because it was on the wire payments. The wire payments were not set up in a way to say, here's exactly what the primary should pay and the general should pay because that's the revenue that they're going to get later. It was just a flat fee set by the vendor as when, you know, so they had their operating cash to be able to fly the plane. Had we known in retrospect that it would be taken by the auditors on those wire payment dates, we would have just structured the contract differently in a more way consistent with maybe what you're saying. But we definitely did not know that that would be required because in 2000 we had done a similar contract for Bush-Cheney that also overlapped with the primary in general. And we used the exact same spreadsheet templates from that audit as we from that campaign as we did for this. The auditors never mentioned any flaw in that system at the time, and so we mentioned it to them now and said that's what we used. They said it was immaterial, but we had no way of knowing that wasn't an okay way to do it. We would have done whatever you had wanted if it was laid out. So we did our best. Based on the past.
One last question. If this is a matter of not really of any harm to the press or any overbilling of the press, but of allocation simply between the primary and the general, why was no rebalancing payment made shortly after the conclusion of the general election campaign?
We noticed when we were prepared, did our final billing, that there would be a misallocation, and we wanted to do a repayment at the time, but we asked our on-site audit staff if we should do that, and they said, please hold off on any kind of repayments until we're finished so we can make sure everything is done right, because they wanted to analyze it themselves. So we just deferred to them, but we did know that there was, right after the election, that issue, and we wanted to correct it.
Thank you all for your presentation.
Thank you. Does the audit staff need anything else from the committee? You have all the documents you need. Great. Well, thank you very much for your time and attention, your presentation, for joining us this morning, and we will be in touch. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Commissioners, Audit General Counsel.
Thank you. That concludes the audit hearing, and our open meeting will begin this morning at 11:45. Thank you.